Welcome to the Refuge Recovery Podcast. Refuge Recovery is a Buddhist-oriented path to recovery from addictions. For more information, please visit us at refugerecovery.org.
Welcome to the first Thursday offering of Refuge Recovery World Services. I'm Noah Levine. Nice to see everybody. Thanks for joining us. Just as a reminder, this is not a refuge recovery meeting. Refuge meetings are peer-led. This is a teacher offering where I will give some meditation instructions that aren't directly from the book and share some teachings that may or may not be directly from the book, where I freestyle a bit and share some teachings that hopefully will be useful in the process of recovery, Buddhist teachings. We begin with a 20-minute meditation, and then I'll say some things and we'll have some time for questions and dialogue with me. So let's start with a meditation, finding a way to sit, place the body in an upright sitting meditation posture. Allowing your eyes to be gently closed and taking a moment to relax into the upright posture by softening, releasing all of the unnecessary tension in the face, the brow, the jaw, the neck, throat, shoulders, chest, belly. Breathing in, feel the sensations that the breath creates. And as you exhale, let everything go, soften, melting the stress of the day, the tension in the body, dissolving, melting, releasing. With each exhale, softening the belly, releasing the jaw, relaxing the shoulders. Establishing mindfulness, present time, kind awareness. The intention to be kind, to be patient, to be friendly, accepting. We relax in the beginning of practice. We soften, not for the sake of relaxation, but for the sake of opening. Often our tension is resistance, aversion, suppression. So in meditation, we soften, not so that we have the experience of being so relaxed, but so that we be open to anything that's being compartmentalized, resisted, subverted. Central part of our mindfulness meditation is learning to tend to our pain, to our sorrow, to our grief, rather than suppressing our grief with a tight belly. We soften the belly, we relax the tension, to allow whatever's here to be felt. And I invite you to spend the first few minutes simply focusing the attention on the sensations that the breath creates. Breathing in, know that you're breathing in. breathing out. Know that you're breathing out. And continuing to soften the belly, relax the tension in the face, the shoulders, with each exhale. Exhaling is letting go of the breath. Letting go of the past, letting go of the future. Letting go of needing even the present to be any different than it is. Non-judgmental, kind awareness of each breath. Each time we get back involved in thinking, the attention leaves the breath, goes back into the thinking mind. Just acknowledge it. Oh, thinking again, planning, remembering, worrying about the future, reminiscing about the past. Then gently return to the breath. Disengage. Let those thoughts continue in the background. Come back to the present time experience of the body, sitting, meditating, breathing. Mindfulness of the breath serves us in two ways. It teaches us to be present and the body and ignore the mind, helps us to break our addiction to the thinking mind, our identification with our thoughts and emotions, seeing that we can choose to disengage, to not obey the mind. And by paying close attention to the breath and body, it also teaches us about impermanence. A constantly changing reality of sensation. Each breath comes and goes. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end to each in-breath. A beginning, middle, and end to each out-breath. The Buddha taught that even just this simple mindfulness of the breath meditation technique could teach us everything we need to know about reality, the nature of impermanence, the unreliable nature of all conditioned phenomena, and the impersonal reality. The body breathes all by itself. The next and equally practical aspect of our mindfulness is to open to the second foundation, the mindfulness of the feeling tones. Even just with the breath, investigating, exploring, inquiring, is this a pleasant sensation as I breathe in or out? Is it unpleasant or neutral? And each time something takes our attention away from the breath, a sound, a thought, another sensation, also inquiring, what's the nature of the feeling tone of this phenomena, this experience? Is this a pleasant thought or unpleasant thought or neutral? Pleasant sound, unpleasant sound, neutral. After sitting in meditation for a few minutes, if the body becomes uncomfortable, often our attention is drawn towards the pain, the discomfort. Becoming aware of the feeling tones of our experience reveals our tendency to crave for pleasure, to resist pain, and begins to teach us how to be uncomfortable, to tolerate, be patient and merciful towards our own discomfort. As we apply the understanding of impermanence, we see that whatever's happening will change, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. Just as each breath comes and goes, each feeling tone arises and sustains and passes. Rather than ignoring the mind opening, this is the third foundation of mindfulness, observing the thoughts arising and passing, the impermanent nature, the tendency for thoughts to proliferate, one thought leading to the next, arising and passing. Through awareness, some thoughts are pleasant, some are unpleasant, all are impermanent. You're ready, allowing your eyes to be open, bringing attention back to the space you're in, continuing present time awareness, acknowledging the impermanent nature of that meditation, which had a beginning, a middle, an end, but mindfulness doesn't have to end. Continuing to be present, to feel the sensations of shifting your body, of stretching, whatever, and even acknowledging, oh, whatever movements I make, it's because it seems like it'll feel pleasant to move in this way, to shift the posture, that almost constant motivation towards what will feel good, what will feel pleasant. So I have, last month, I came to the completion of a several month series of going through the Four Truths and Eightfold Path. And last month we finished the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. We talked about concentration. If you're just tuning in and you want to go back and you can listen to all of those, they're all on the Refuge Recovery podcast on the website and on the different podcast platforms. I thought we would look at this section of the book tonight, back to kind of the beginning of the book, right after the introduction. There's these pages called The Process, XI, three or four pages that in Refuge meetings we read. The first part of this, we read the first page about how we follow the traditional Buddhist system of the Four Noble Truths. We read this in every meeting, but just we only read it down to, we read a sort of abbreviated version of it. So I thought I'd share it and then use this as the discussion, starting on XII. After the Eightfold Path is named, it says, the core philosophy of Refuge Recovery is based on renunciation and abstinence. We believe that the recovery process truly begins when renunciation is established and maintained. We also understand that imperfection and humility are a part of the process. Even when we refrain from the primary drug or behavior, addiction at times manifests in other behaviors. We're not holding perfection as the standard, but as the goal. We believe in the human ability and potential for complete renunciation of behaviors that cause harm. We understand that for many, this is an ongoing process of establishing and/or reestablishing renunciation. Now, this is a pretty radical statement. We believe in, I'm going to do some commentary. We believe in the human ability and potential for complete renunciation of behaviors that cause harm. How many times have we heard or have we said to justify our harm-causing behaviors, I'm only human. You ever use that one? Somebody ever used that one on you? I'm like, I'm only human. And this is where Buddhism creates this pretty, radically tall order, kind of high bar. So for instance, Western psychology, the early psychologists, Freud and some of the early, psychoanalysis people had statements like, we think the best psychotherapy can do is transform neurotic suffering into ordinary human suffering. And that's really the goal of psychology. If we can help you not have the neurotic suffering of, whatever it is, and just have the ordinary suffering of being alive, the ordinary imperfection. The 12 step, I don't want to diss 12 steps. I'm a fan, but I just want to point out that in the 12 step, there's some statements around, you know, like spiritual awakening and recovery being, becoming, there's a statement, it says becoming a worker amongst workers, becoming kind of that we recover from the seemingly hopeless state of alcoholism or addiction, and we return to the sort of normalcy that people that aren't addicts experience. I feel like they're very connected to that statement from psychology of like, you can recover from your addictions and you'll return to a sort of normal, you know, suffering of the normal suffering of life. That I'm only human. I'm not an alcohol. I'm not in alcoholism anymore. I'm not in addiction anymore. But Buddhism offers this radical perspective that says it's possible to end suffering and to live in a life of integrity and honesty and compassion that doesn't intentionally cause harm to ourselves or anybody else. Now, unintentionally, we might still step on an ant and, you know, murder. You might still unintentionally offend somebody with your sense of humor, but the freedom from intentionally causing harm. And this pretty radical statement that says we believe in the human ability and potential for complete renunciation of behaviors that cause harm, complete renunciation of addiction and participating in process addictions or substance-based addictions, total abstinence, complete sobriety. You know, and this abstinence doesn't mean that people that have neurotic suffering don't utilize, you know, medicine, psychotropic, prescribed by physicians, medicine. We're not one of those perspectives that says don't take the drugs that your doc, your psychiatrist is prescribing. Although we know a lot of psychiatrists overprescribe, but you know, we don't get to have an opinion on that, you know. But abstinence from recreational drugs and alcohol, and abstinence from unethical behavior that causes harm. Next paragraph. Renunciation alone is not recovery, however. It is only the beginning. Those who maintain abstinence but fail to examine the underlying causes and conditions are not on the path to recovery. They are simply stopping the surface manifestation of addiction, which will inevitably surface in other ways. This is addressing the phenomena of the dry drunk, or the clean but not recovered addict. People, you know, who's like, well, I haven't drank in decades, but you know, that sort of the way that the woundedness and the anger and the fear and the self-centeredness, we haven't recovered joy, we haven't recovered compassion, we haven't recovered wisdom, and that sort of abstinence alone is not recovery. From our perspective, the eight factors or folds of the path are to be developed, experienced, and penetrated. This is not a linear path that does not have to be taken in order. In fact, all of the factors need to be developed and applied simultaneously. This is the section that we read in the meetings. And to truly break free from addiction, the eight folds of recovery must be constantly maintained. Although the process and sequence of recovery will vary from person to person, the following is an overview of how the refuge recovery approach may be applied. We begin by accepting all the ways that addiction has caused suffering in our lives and the lives of others. Turning inward, we acknowledge our suffering acknowledging our suffering is the beginning of the process, but it's also an ongoing practice. So we do the, you know, kind of, as we come into recover, we say, oh yeah, I'm here because I've been suffering. And I see how it's, you know, my addictions and my, have caused suffering to me. I see how it's caused suffering to other people in my life. We do the first truth inventory, which reveals a lot of specific ways that suffering has manifested in our life. Some of it is about addiction. Some of it's also just about the normal neurotic suffering of humans. Not all of it is addiction based. Some of our suffering is just self-centeredness. But also an ongoing practice. On a daily basis, we practice mindfulness of suffering, its causes and its cessation, pointing to the impermanence that I was encouraging us to investigate in the meditation tonight. The suffering, its causes. The cause is always clinging to something that's impermanent, resisting something that's impermanent, or taking something personal that's not so personal. These three characteristics of a clinging, aversion, self-centeredness, which is the Buddha's formula, greed, hatred, delusion, greed for pleasure, hatred of pain, delusion of I, me, mine, clinging, self-centeredness. The causes and its cessation, they're impermanent. Even attachment is impermanent. You cling, and at some point, it's, you know, you crave, even craving. Even when you're in active addiction, you feel like, I was craving all of the time. But if you were mindful, you would see craving arises and passes. Sometimes you've satisfied those cravings. The problem with craving is that it's repetitive. No matter how many times you solve it, no matter how many times you satisfy your craving, it comes back. It repeats. Satisfy this one, it repeats. Satisfy this one, it repeats. And the kind of, they call it, I think it's neuroscience that calls it a hedonic treadmill. That you, no matter what, you're always hedonism, seeking pleasure, craving, craving. You're on a treadmill. And as we know from a treadmill, you just, there's no end to it. It's a cycle, repetitive. So on a daily basis, we practice mindfulness of the truth of what's happening, you know, when we're suffering, its causes and its cessation. Next, we investigate the underlying conditions that have influenced, exacerbated, and perpetuated our addictions. This is pointing to our practice of the second truth inventory, of looking at on pen and paper or keyboard, writing out, investigating, and acknowledging the underlying conditions. Through reading, listening, studying, and practicing the principles of the four truths, which include the Eightfold Path, we come to understand the possibility and potential of our own recovery. Having some inkling of hope and willingness, we take refuge in the potential of our own recovery, in the four truths, Eightfold Path of recovery, and in the community of fellow recovering addicts. And this is the Buddha Dharma Sangha. So this is the traditional Buddhist formula of the path to liberation. The path to recovery is we take refuge and, you know, in the potential, you know, taking refuge in Buddha isn't about the painting behind me. It's not about the religion. It's about Buddha means awake. And so it's committing to waking up and for our own personal waking up, not somebody else's, not Siddhartha Gautama 2,600 years ago, not a statue in your living room, not a church, not a temple, not a monastery, not a statue, and not even really the historical person, but the potential of your own recovery, recovering that, what we call Buddha nature, awakened potential of the human heart. Four truths, Eightfold Path, and the community, the Sangha, the groups that we are connecting with and supporting and being supported by. We embark on the practice of the Eightfold Path. We encourage you to begin with the practice of meditation right away. Meditation is going to be the most important tool in supporting our renunciation. Begin with the practice of focusing on your breath. After a week, you will begin to alternate forgiveness practice and with breath, forgiveness practice with the breath practice every other day. Eventually, we'll want to learn and practice all of the meditations offered, but we encourage you to first develop the meditations that increase concentration. I don't think I explained it here, but focusing on the breath and repeating the forgiveness phrases are both concentration practices. They're both practices that allow us to ignore our craving mind. In the beginning of recovery, we need a distraction from the cravings. We need to not be in the craving mind. And so each time you come back to the breath, you disengage from the thoughts. You don't stop the mind, but it's an intervention from the mind that might be saying, hey, you should get high, you should do this, you should do that, you should engage in this behavior, that behavior, come back to the breath. Each time we say, I forgive you as much as I can in this moment, again, we're replacing thoughts, we're training the mind, we're concentrating the mind. And forgiveness and the heart practices are sort of twofold. We're creating positive mind habits, healing underlying resenting tendencies and wounds, and we're concentrating. So we get that distraction by saying the phrase, and we also get that potential healing that forgiveness is. As your skill and concentration increases, we begin practicing the four foundations of mindfulness and the heart practices of loving kindness, compassion, appreciation, and equanimity. I think there's 15 or 16 guided meditations in refuge recovery. The four foundations, the mindfulness of the breath and body, mindfulness of the feeling tones, mindfulness of the mind, which we have two parts, the process of thoughts arising and passing, and the content and becoming present with the feeling tone of the different content of the thoughts. And the fourth, the mindfulness of the truth, which is coming to see the five hindrances and the seven awakening, a lot of lists on that one, but it's about the truth of our experience. Practicing forgiveness, loving kindness, compassion, appreciation, and equanimity, training in concentration and training in positive emotions, the emotion of love, the emotion of appreciation, gratitude, the emotion of compassion, mercy, caring, learning to be uncomfortable and learning to care about discomfort. If we want to recover, we have to have a different relationship to our pain. So much of our addictive experience was trying to create pleasure and avoid pain. In recovery, we have to realize that pain is inescapable, and we have to develop a wise relationship to pain. It's inevitable. Compassion is the only solution to the unpleasant human condition. Next, we refine understanding, intentions, and livelihood. This is when we're getting into the Eightfold Path. This is a gradual path. No one changes overnight, but we all must continue to practice, study, and act wisely to find the freedom from addiction we seek. We engage in the relational aspect of forgiveness, making amends to people we have hurt through our addictions, words, our actions. Compassionate action is an integral aspect of the path. We encourage you to find ways to be of service, to be generous, to be kind. Once you maintain renunciation for over a year and establish a regular meditation practice and complete the inventories, it says here, this was my original, I've edited this since, and so I hate to even admit that it said this, but what it says is that once you've maintained renunciation for over a year, established a regular meditation practice, completed the inventories, you're ready to become a mentor for newer members. Now, I changed that because I feel like, you know, when I was creating Refuge Recovery, I was just sort of like making it up as I went of like, well, you know, I want people to mentor each other that have some experience. And so I thought, oh yeah, if you got a year and you're meditating, you've done your inventories, then start mentoring. And what we have found 10 years in is that there's not enough mentors in meetings, and that we needed to lower the bar. We needed to follow the model of the 12-step self-help groups, mutual aid societies, which is that, you know, if you've got a week, help the person that has a day. You know, the lowest bar of that is like, hey, you got 2 days, be of service from the beginning. Don't let things like this, and I've changed this, I've taken it out of the second edition, we've put the thing, we've edited on the mentorship. Don't wait till you're meditating every day before you're being of service. Be of service from the beginning of your recovery. Mentor each other pretty early on, rather than this too high of a bar that I originally created. Last part of this section. We will maintain daily meditation practices and relationships with the community of recovering people, committing to our practice and this really important last part of that, which says we will maintain daily relationships with the community of recovering people. It is incredibly common that people, after some period of recovery, people, we come to recovery programs because we're suffering and we're desperate. And then hopefully you get some recovery and you're not so suffering, you're not so desperate. And people fall away and they stop the association with the with the Sangha, with the recovering community. And not everybody relapses, but it's, you know, everybody that relapses, not everybody, but a lot of people that relapse say, yeah, I stopped associating with recovering. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped doing the stuff. And then I relapse. Not everybody that stops doing the stuff relapses. Or stops coming relapses, but there's something missing. I had a conversation with somebody earlier today who has decades of abstinence, of recovery, stopped participating in recovery groups long time ago, maybe over a decade ago, and was kind of asking me for some direction of like, hey, what should I, you know, I'm meditating and I'm doing this thing, but I don't really, feels like something's missing. And I said, well, go to a meeting, start mentoring people again, start being of service, like get back engaged in the community of being part of a community. Even if you've got 30, 40 years sober, be part of this thing, keep showing up. It's a central part of the Buddha's teachings to be part of community. It's a relational spiritual path that we're on. And it's a core part of recovery. Of the way this thing works is that we keep showing up for each other. Not because we need to get something, because we're here to give something, because we're here to be of service and to carry it forward, to pass on, you know, just like all of the people that were here for us when we showed up and they freely offered their time and energy and took our phone calls and showed up to the meetings with us, then it's our turn to do that for the rest of our lives on a daily basis to show up for each other. Maybe it sounds like a tall order. It's what's worked for me so far in my recovery, 36 years in so far, meditating, showing up, being of service, this eightfold path. So I'll open it up. We got 15 minutes for questions, comments, clarifications, discussion. You can raise your hand in the reactions tab and I will call on you, and when I call on you, you can unmute yourself and we can chat if you want. You got nothing for me tonight? Florian, go ahead, unmute yourself.
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you for doing this. So I've been doing a lot of the forgiveness practice, and I've been noticing that I have a very strong reaction and develop the urge to drink when I'm done. And I've been avoiding the forgiveness practice since, because I'm scared of falling back into drinking.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if I should try shorter meditations and see where it takes me.
Sounds like a good idea, maybe to do a little bit less, you know, when something is difficult like that. So here's the issue from my perspective. If we don't forgive, I don't think we'll probably stay sober long-term, or even if we do stay sober, we might be in that kind of dry drunk dilemma, of sort of not very happy, not very free. You know, those we're as free as we, you know, as long as we're clinging to our pain and our resentments. So I feel like forgiveness is a necessity. And I get what you're saying. And I'm sure so many people's head are nodding of like, yeah, when I turn towards that shit, that pain makes me thirsty. You know, like my mind says, hey, you don't want to feel this pain of those resentments, of those wounds, of those abuses, of those betrayals or the guilt or whatever it is. So maybe it is skillful sometimes to just do a few minutes.
Okay.
Just dip a toe in, like, and so maybe the way that you could do that is do 5 minutes of forgiveness and then switch back to mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Do some forgiveness in the beginning and then switch to one of the other practices that feel more stabilizing. So maybe that's mindfulness. Maybe that's forgiveness. Maybe that's loving kindness. Does loving kindness have a similar effect?
No, not at all.
So do 5 minutes of forgiveness and then shift to loving kindness.
Okay.
And then see how that goes. Because, you know, you're going to dysregulate yourself a little bit with the forgiveness and then regulate yourself with the metta, the loving kindness or the mindfulness. And then see, what if I do 10 minutes and then do some metta? And, you know, do 10 minutes and then check in 5 minutes and then, you know what I'm saying? Increase it to the point where you can, it's exposure therapy. It's like, okay, I'm exposing myself to this pain, to these resentments. And can I increase my tolerance for it? And can I increase my ability to be with this? And then eventually, over the months or years, you'll find, oh, actually, now I can do forgiveness. And it's painful, but I'm actually quite okay with being in that place. And I'm not getting the strong cravings. I've actually shifted towards, it's okay to be with this.
Okay. Yeah.
Good to see you, Flo.
Likewise. Thank you, Norma.
Welcome. Worth, go ahead.
Hey, Noah, this is maybe a little off topic from what you shared tonight, but I've gotten a number of people with concern, fear, and anxiety since the election. And I'm wondering if you have any advice or wisdom to share on how to best support people who might be going through more now than they were even this weekend in terms of this feeling of existential threat.
Well, first and foremost, and I'm sure you're already doing this, which is just kind of empathizing and listening and kind of being present for each other. Compassionate ear, compassionate listening is a big part of it. And then as far as if they're asking, you don't want to give too much unsolicited advice, but if they're asking for practice advice, the context of, I don't think I put this in Refuge Recovery, but the context of metta, loving kindness, the may all beings be at ease, may all beings be free from suffering, may all beings be happy, is the context. It's said that the Buddha taught that as an antidote to fear. And so, you know, the question about the political change and situation in the States, and the fear that might be coming up for people and feeling unsafe or whatever, the Buddhist antidote to fear is having love and kindness for ourselves and for each other. May all beings be at ease is the antidote to fear. May all beings be free from suffering is the antidote to fear. May all beings be happy is the antidote to fear. And it's that sort of like seeing that in this sort of divided political climate that those on this side are suffering, those on that side are suffering, and all beings want to be free from suffering. And the more we connect with that love and kindness and compassion, it's not going to make the future be any different than it is, but it's going to make our relationship to what happens much smoother, much less suffering about the fear of what's going to happen, more tending to what's happening right now in our hearts and our minds. So loving kindness would be the, I mean, several people asked me in the last couple of days, what practice should I do through these difficult times? And metta, loving kindness, has been my suggestion. So that's my suggestion for you too. Does that fit, Worth?
Yeah, thank you. That's exactly, I think, the feedback I was looking for.
Welcome. Good to see you and look forward to seeing you down there in the retreat in May.
Yeah, 100%.
Mark, go ahead.
Hey, Noah. Thanks for the meditation and showing up tonight. I want to touch back on the forgiveness and some other things. One of the things that's always, I liked it in your teachings, that we don't have to start off with the most difficult people or the most difficult situations. Start with maybe forgiveness or making the amends, not to the most difficult amends that we have to go out, but just along with what we do anyways is practice. Practice showing forgiveness for someone that may be easier than the more difficult ones. And knowing that the saying that you said, I'm wanting to give forgiveness as much as I can at this time, at this moment. So I just really wanted to, that's something that's always stood out when you talked about that. And I didn't hear you mention that a little earlier, but that's helped me a lot. So yeah. I want to thank you for that.
Absolutely. Good to see you, Mark. I'm not sure. I guess I was sort of under the assumption that you're aware of all of that context flow that, you know, in order to do the forgiveness, sometimes we do, we have this tendency, we say forgiveness, and then we think about the biggest resentment that we have, or we think about the worst thing that we've ever done, the unforgivable, or you know, it, rather than the encouragement, which Mark is reminding us about, of like, start with like the image that's sometimes used is like, if you're going to go start bodybuilding, you're going to go start weightlifting. Don't go with the heaviest, you know, start with the 5 and 10 pound resentments. Start with the 5 and 10 pound unskillful, you know, things that we've done, the harm that we've caused, and then work your way up to the 200 pound resentments. And so, you know, also looking at that flow in your practice of like, what if I just send forgiveness to like, you know, somebody annoying at work and not my childhood trauma? What if I just send, you know, practice the forgiveness towards, you know, myself for some of the minor shoplifting, not the, you know, armed robbery or whatever it was, you know, like kind of just start small and then work your way up with the practice. And also that context of separating the actor from the action when we're forgiving. Remember that we're forgiving the confused, suffering person, us or others, and we're not forgiving the action or the behavior, not the, you know, not the action, just the actor. That's makes it possible. Laurel, last one for tonight.
Hi, thank you for the meeting. I just wanted to say this is my first meeting, and I've heard that there is a meeting in Hoboken, but it's not in the on the website. I was just wondering if that was true. New Jersey, Hoboken, New Jersey.
Sorry. Yeah, it's possible that it's true, but okay. If it's not on the website, we wouldn't know whether it's true or not. Hey, I thought I saw Pete here early. Pete, you still here? Peter Grimm.
I'm here. Yeah, we had to shut it down. But
is Hoboken happening or not?
No, we shut it down, but we're reopening it in Leonia, New Jersey. I'm just trying to find a spot with the town here. It's in Bergen County.
Laurel, maybe Pete, maybe you and Laurel could get your number or something. Peter's the one that was running that group in Jersey, and he'll probably be the one that gets it going again. So if you connect with him, or he can connect you with some other women in that New Jersey Sangha, that would be good.
Great. Thank you so much.
And Sebastian, just in the print in the chat, put up what meeting is that?
Location of New Jersey website.
Yeah, so it looks like maybe the Hoboken one isn't happening, but he put in the chat the other ones that might be close-ish to you.
Okay, great. Thank
you. And
yeah.
Also, just as a reminder, Laurel, This is not a refuge recovery meeting.
Right. So I guess I shouldn't say it's my first meeting. Yeah. I guess it's my first.
Welcome. Totally welcome. Yeah, totally welcome. But don't expect this at a refuge recovery
meeting. Right.
And if anybody's doing this at a refuge recovery meeting, please let us know. Because they shouldn't be giving people advice the way that I am.
Right. Okay.
Please, got it. Please let us know. That shouldn't be happening much. But welcome. Welcome. And I hope you do find a meeting. And yeah, Pete, maybe you can connect her with some people out in that area.
All right. Perfect. Thank you.
Welcome. We'll leave it there for tonight. Good to see everybody. I'm off this next week. I'll see you in December. I think it's whatever the first Thursday in December is. I'll see you then. But in the next couple of weeks, I'm taking 27 people from Refuge Recovery to India, to the place where the Buddha was born and the Buddha was enlightened and the Buddha died. We're going on the Refuge Recovery Buddhist pilgrimage. I'm sorry that all of you aren't joining me for that, but maybe next year we'll do it again, or we'll do something again. And so hopefully I'll have some stories from that pilgrimage to share with you at next month's first Thursday. If we all survive, we'll see. But good to see everybody. May any goodness that comes from this be shared with all beings in all directions. May each one of us recover, and together may we create a positive change on this planet. Lastly, if you feel moved, please consider a donation to Refuge Recovery World Services. We could use your support. Consider becoming a monthly supporter of the nonprofit. So whatever you feel moved to do, we request your financial support. We'll leave it there.
Refuge Recovery is freely offered. If you'd like to make a donation to support us, you may do so by following the link in the episode notes. We appreciate your generosity.